Welcome to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. I'm Lindsay Maynard. Today we'll take you to Colby College in Waterville for a talk entitled The Future of Conservation. Today's speaker is Dr. Eric Dinnerstein, the Chief Scientist and Vice President of Conservation Science at the World Wildlife Fund. An expert on global biodiversity and large mammal biology, among other things, Dinnerstein will discuss the future of endangered species and the effects of humans and industrialized nations on wildlife. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. This program will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand to hear the program again at your convenience or to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. This program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Jasmine Ching, an environmental studies major at Colby College.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the opening of this year's Environmental Studies Evening Lecture Series. Today, we're honored to have Dr. Eric Dinnerstein, Chief Scientist and Vice President for Conservation Science at the World Wildlife Fund. Unlike many biologists, who would often trace their love of nature back to an idyllic childhood spent with salamanders or bugs, Dr. Dinnerstein probably never planned on tracking tigers in Nepal or studying bats in Costa Rica as an undergraduate film student at Northwestern University. But thanks to some wonderful teachers and a little green heron that he accidentally scared away, Dr. Dinnerstein has traveled to the world's most remote places today to defend rare species and their threatened habitats. It's never too late to start an adventure that may turn into something extraordinary. And it was in Nepal where he conducted a census of the tiger population as a Peace Corps volunteer that Dr. Dinnerstein began his conservation career. This experience led him to champion the idea of larger landscape-level conservation for species protection. Considered groundbreaking at the time, this approach is now standard practice for large mammal conservation. At World Wildlife Fund, Dr. Dinnerstein has led an unprecedented effort to identify every ecoregion on the planet and define the most biologically important species, known as the Global 200. He has helped develop strategies to protect a number of endangered species, including one-horned rhinos, tigers, and elephants. Additionally, Dr. Dinnerstein has published extensively on these topics. Today, Dr. Dinnerstein will lead us on a journey of his endeavors from the Amazon to eastern Montana to discuss what he sees as the major concerns for conservation over the coming decades. And now please join me and welcome Dr. Eric Dinnerstein.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I've heard a lot about this college. It figures prominently in my program at World Wildlife Fund because I actually have a staff member whose name is Colby. And I took a picture of myself next to the original Mr. Colby and just emailed it to him. If there's a phone call that interrupts my talk, it's probably him emailing back to me or calling his, how thrilled he was that the college was named after him and he saw the picture. We'll have to Photoshop it in. He has bright red hair, so I'm not sure if he'd actually help you or hurt you in terms of your fundraising. But he is one of the people who's actually contributed to some of this work tonight, so you'll hear about that. What I'd like to do tonight is to cover a wide range of topics and identify what I think are some of the most important aspects, some of the most important challenges for global biodiversity conservation in the coming decades. I'll begin with starting at a very small scale of looking at pinpointing the most important places on Earth where nature is concentrated, where, as you've probably learned in your classes, that we're scientists say that we're in the midst of the sixth great extinction crisis in the history of our planet. The species are going extinct at the rate of 100 to 1,000 times faster than they normally should be, what would be the normal background rate of extinction in other periods. And from these really epicenters of imminent extinctions, we're going to go the other route to look at where globally we should be focusing our attention, where most of nature is concentrated, particularly in the tropics. and to think about how to do conservation at the scale of landscape. So not just Acadia National Park, but say a large area of northern Maine or other parts of the United States or even the rest of the world. And then I'm going to try to introduce some new technologies that I think are really promising for nature conservation and how to propel us forward. And because Philip invited me, I know his passion is tigers and so is mine, I'm going to end on some of the work that I've been doing with my colleagues on trying to save one of the most charismatic species on Earth. That sound okay? Okay, so let's go. Well, some of the work that we've been doing, as Jasmine mentioned, is to really identify those places on Earth where biodiversity is really concentrated. And you probably couldn't pick, this doesn't quite resemble Mount Katahdin. This is, starts with a K as well. This is Mount Kinabalu, a little bit different mountain. It's probably the highest, it is the highest mountain between the peaks of New Guinea and the Himalayas. It's about 13,500 feet, a granite peak, that there are probably more species found isolated to a single mountaintop on this mountain in northern Borneo than anywhere on Earth. For example, it's if you're a species of fig, there are about 750 species in the genus Ficus in the lower left-hand corner, and about 75 are endemic, meaning only found on Mount Kinabalu. It's a place where it has the highest concentration of these insectivorous pitcher plants in the middle there, and there are probably as almost 100 species of orchids, of 26,000 species of orchids in the world, the most diverse family of flowering plants, that the highest concentration anywhere on Earth is on Mount Kinabalu. It also has some unique species, like the one in the upper right. This is Rafflesia, the world's largest flowering plant. It's actually a parasite on the vines of species in the grape family that smells like a lot of tropical flowers, like rotting dead meat. It resembles maybe a dead monkey that attracts carrion flies that does the pollination. But the point here is that on this single mountain, like many tropical mountains, this is where biodiversity is concentrated. And a few years ago, some other scientists and I got together and decided when people say, make claims like, we're in the middle of the sixth great extinction crisis in the history of our planet, we're losing species at the rate of 100 a day, and the cynics say, okay, name them. And so what we did was go through an analysis of all the places on Earth, like Mount Kinabalu, that has the Kinabalu rat. That wasn't as glamorous to show, so I used flowers instead. But importantly, the Kinabalu rat only lives on Mount Kinabalu. You lose this site, you lose the species forever. And the study that we did found that if you ask the question, how many places are there on Earth where the entire the species is limited to a single site, plow it, pave it, burn it, flood it, and that species is gone forever, we found 600 sites with about 800 species of birds, mammals, reptiles, or amphibians where it's the only place on Earth that exists. And you lose that, you lose it forever. So those are places in the future that we really have to target where it's the only chance left to save them from extinction. But thinking more broadly, as Jasmine mentioned, a large part of my work and my team has been to map biodiversity, the variety and variability of life on Earth across the planet. And we came up with this idea of the global 200 ecoregions. So the ones that are shown in color here are the ones where nature is concentrated as a way of thinking about it. Just like oil, natural gas, gold, uranium, it's not distributed evenly across the planet. There are places you would go to find it. The same thing for nature conservation. So what this map shows is those ecoregions, roughly 200, that are the most diverse rainforests, the most diverse deserts, the most diverse Mediterranean scrub systems, the most diverse lakes, the most diverse rivers and streams, the most diverse coral reef systems, etc. And together, they give us a tremendous amount of perhaps 90% of all species. The rationale is simple. If we conserve the most diverse habitats on Earth, we'll probably conserve more than 90% of the world's species. And some of these are the ones here. For example, the Chihuahuan Desert. It sounds like a small desert, but it's actually quite large because it's not named after Chihuahuas. But it's the place of radiation for the prickly pear cactus. There are more than 40 species there. The nearby Sonoran Desert with the saguaros get a lot more pub, but this is actually a much more diverse desert. Or the Namib Karoo, where I met Philip a few years ago, that is perhaps the most diverse desert in the world for vertebrate species. The forest that the pandas occupy is the most diverse temperate broadleaf forest in the world. The coral reefs of the East African marine system, or the coral triangle, 500 species of hard corals and tropical fish, by far the most diverse. But even polar seas and subpolar seas like the Bering Sea, which isn't rich in terms of species number, but is unique for these amazing aggregations of species. So in this case, short-tailed shearwaters and humpback whales congregating in these huge numbers that you don't see anywhere else on the planet. The interesting elephant fish from the Congo rivers and streams that uses electric currents to navigate. And then two species of lemurs from Madagascar, the lazy lemur in the middle and the jujitsu lemur on top. Actually, they're not. There are other names. But here's an example of an island with an endemic mammal fauna unique to anywhere in the world. Lemurs once ranged across Africa. Madagascar split off 150 million years ago. With lemurs on them, they radiated into many different species. And so it's a place where biodiversity, again, is concentrated. So that was the idea of the Global 200. Now, I want to shift to something that's a bit closer to home, although this is the other side of the country where I went to graduate school and undergraduate, and one of my first jobs was surveying the Mount Baker National Forest. That's Mount Baker there in the background, and the spotted owl. Now, many of you have probably heard of it, and those of you who study environmental policy know that this was the owl that launched 1,000 lawsuits. This was a species that is a rare old-growth forest species that requires very ancient forest to live in, and that forest, as you can see in this picture here, was becoming increasingly scarce because of logging practices. And the reason why I use this as a slide is because if we only conserve a small national park, we would never conserve the spotted owls. To have a viable population, you need whopping big areas of temperate rainforest in this part of the world. And so this began to get biologists thinking more and more about the critical issue of landscape scale conservation. I wish I could take credit for this slide, but it was produced by a colleague of mine, Mark Anderson, at the Nature Conservancy, but it illustrates two really important points, and if you take away nothing else from my talk tonight, maybe just hang on to this one, which is that when you look from left to right, we see an increasing scale in terms of the size of a reserve that does two things. First, as we go from small to large, the reserves become big enough to support those species that require large areas to breed, so starting with very small species that don't need much area to have, say, thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of them, all the way to the top predators that are very territorial that need large areas. And then similarly, what's often neglected is that very small areas are not able to function naturally because some of the ecological processes, be it windstorms or fire or hurricanes or major ecological events that structure these systems, only really function when they operate at very large scales. And to see them operate naturally in these systems, you need really large areas. So this is the biological basis for why we have to do conservation much larger than just single national parks and think about whole landscapes with parks embedded in them. And that's been a large part of the work that I've done over the last 25 years. Now, most of my work has been overseas. As Jasmine has mentioned, I started out in Nepal studying tigers, a territorial species that ranges over large areas, and elephants as well. And during the years I was doing research overseas, that I realized that we can go over, Americans are really good at proselytizing. We're really good at going somewhere else and telling people what to do. But when it comes down to doing some of the same things in our own country, sometimes we're not as good at that. And one of them is doing large mammal conservation. We know the controversy over wolves and grizzly bears. And it occurred to me that when I go overseas and try to work with developing country biologists and government officials and say, well, we need to set aside these large areas for tiger conservation. And those are those individuals who have studied American history will know about what we did to our own bison population and to the Native Americans that relied on those populations, is that there may have been as many as 60 million bison trampling the Great Plains of the United States and Canada and all the way down to Mexico. And that system has largely disappeared, and very quickly. We basically wiped out the bison to really wipe out the Indians and put them on reservations. So a few years ago, several colleagues of mine and I got together and we asked the question to ourselves, is there any place in the United States in the lower 48 that we could restore the grandeur that Lewis and Clark knew, that we could create one of these giant landscapes and maybe someday have a system where we'd have Native American bison being followed by wolves and grizzlies in hot pursuit. And this idea, you know, we think of wolves and grizzlies as Rocky Mountain species. They're not. They're grassland species. It's just that we push them there because that's the only place left for them to survive. So we began to look around, was there any place where we could pull off a kind of experiment like this? And we found a place, Drat, this is going to be one of your neighbors, so you Mainers won't appreciate this, but we found a place that's about on the Upper Missouri River Breaks area in eastern central Montana that is the size of the state of Connecticut. Excuse me, I didn't have the Maine outline to put in here, but you get the idea. This area is 2 times the size of Yellowstone, about 5,000 square miles, and if we could put it under conservation, would be by far the largest national park or national reserve in the United States, and that became our idea about 12 years ago. Now, you look at this picture and you think, okay, well, this is that area, and you know, maybe there's a few straggly pronghorn antelope way in the distance, but essentially it's an empty landscape. It had cattle on it, but it had the native grasses intact. So really they just took off the bison and put on this exotic, ecologically unfit creature called the cow and put it on here, and that was the ecology for the last 200 years. But if you look back in time, that period is an aberration. This is a place that is meant for bison. It's too hot in the summer, too windy, too dry, too cold in the winter with blizzards. This is not an environment where cattle evolved in. With less than 12 inches of rain a year, it's not an ecosystem suitable for grazing livestock, but it's wonderful for bison. So a few years ago, watch the lower right-hand corner of the screen, but it was empty of any large mammals except for, as I said, a few pronghorn, which you can't see here, and some elk. Is we hit the re-bison button. And about 5 years ago, we began transplanting bison from Wind Cave National Park and Elk Island Reserve in Canada that are genetically pure. So we're starting a herd. There are about 500,000 bison in the United States, but most of them are on very small ranches. That's where you get your buffalo meat from, which is wonderful. But there's a very high level of mixture of cattle genes in wild bison, in the bison genome. And so we started out with only those bison that passed a rigorous test that we knew to be genetically pure. And bison are just one of the important elements of this ecosystem. It's also home to the black-tailed prairie dog, which, along with bison, are what we call the landscape engineers that through the manuring, grazing, wallowing, defecating of the bison, they change the landscape around them, as do the black-tailed prairie dogs when they're in high numbers. They were once black-tailed prairie dog or prairie dog towns the size of my home state of Maryland in the United States. That's how big they were. Now their range has shrunk to probably more than 95%, and one of the places where they do survive very well still is in the northern Great Plains. This is also the place for the signature raptor, the ferruginous hawk that feeds on the prairie dogs. The prairie dogs are part of this important ecosystem. It's the last important lekking areas for the greater sage grouse, which should be an endangered species, should be listed. And of course, the most endangered mammal in North America, the black-footed ferret, whose 90% of its diet is the prairie dog. It's also an important ecosystem for the wolves. Wolves come down from Canada and find their way into this area. When they get out of the reserve, they get shot. But eventually, the idea is that we're going to purchase enough ranches in this area to create this ecosystem. And 2 years ago, two young male grizzlies decided to head off the Front Range in Montana and wander down along the Missouri just up to Fort Benton, and were about 65 miles away from the reserve when they got caught and sent home. But eventually, we're going to have an area, as I said, twice the size of Yellowstone with the second with the largest elk herd in east of the Rockies, with over probably 5,000 animals, enough to support a wolf pack and eventually a grizzly bear population. So this is our vision, and this is the important one, the first important points I want to get across about landscape conservation is you have to start with the vision. What is it that you want to achieve and bring back? So our vision is that by 2022, we'll have 10,000 bison stampeding across 1 million acres with grizzly bears and wolves in hot pursuit. Now, we may not get to 10,000 by 2022, but we'll certainly get to at least 6, hopefully, and then we'll see really the restoration of this iconic ecosystem in North America. Okay, that's North America, that's the idea of landscapes. Now I'm going to skip to the next topic, which is the next great challenge in the future of conservation is saving rainforests. We know that tropical rainforests, like the Amazon, probably support more than 50 or 60% of all the species on Earth. So if we want to save life on Earth, rainforests are a great place to start. The problem is that rainforests are being converted at a very, very rapid rate. This is an area, this is the western arc of the Amazon in Peru, and this is the Amazon like you've never seen it before because it's been recreated using a new kind of technology, using an airborne laser flying over the rainforest and showing the rainforest in a unique way, which is how much carbon is contained there. So essentially, the taller the trees, the brighter red they are, the more carbon they have. And then the areas that are in blue, in the opposite way, are the places that have lost the forest, that are cleared pastures or regrowing forests, that are in bluer shades. And one of the important aspects of tropical rainforest conservation right now is how do we maintain the integrity of these rainforests? We need a lot of the species occur at very low densities. We need large areas. And so the challenge is that there is a new mechanism in place called RED, which stands for Reduced Emissions from Deforestation and Forest Degradation, that could at some point become a global mechanism for the rich countries of the West that don't have tropical forests to pay the poor countries that are covered by tropical forests to keep those forests intact. Because as we know, about 15 to 20% of global greenhouse gas emissions come from the conversion of forests, and 80% of that comes from tropical forests. So economists agree, economists, biologists, clear-thinking people, non-Tea Partiers, agree that the most economic way to address the climate change issue is to save tropical forests. That's where the greenhouse gases are going to come from. But the first problem to create this sort of market for it is to estimate accurately how much carbon is there. So the way that we do that, and it wasn't possible before, is a breakthrough new technology developed by our partners at the Carnegie Institute for Science and Greg Astner and other partners in the country of Finland, using essentially an airborne laser that flies over the rainforest and creates a three-dimensional map of the forest. It's very efficient. It flies at about 20,000 hectares a day. The plane doesn't look as sophisticated as this. It's very accurate, and it's a cost now of only about 4 cents a hectare. We've done this in a number of countries to demonstrate that that this has become gone from sort of pie-in-the-sky technology to a hopeful experiment to actually business as usual. So this is the idea of RED, is that there's quite a bit of emissions that come from deforestation. This new treaty is in place. If the international community could develop this exchange of paying countries to keep their forests intact, then we would have a way of getting at the problem of reducing greenhouse gas emissions and the great threat of climate change that is the biggest threat for the next 50 years. This is what the three-dimensional laser looks like. It'll show, for example, a forest clearing, secondary forest, and then forest degradation in a way that we've never seen it before. This was the first pilot that we did in the Amazon rainforest that Pentagon in the area known as Madre de Dios in southeastern Peru. This is probably the richest rainforest on Earth. More plants, more bugs, more mammals, more birds, more anything here than just about anywhere else in the tropics. That Pentagon looks small, but it's actually twice the size or the size of Switzerland, and twice the size of the forests of the country of Costa Rica. So this was a rather large experiment. And what we found is that using this technique of combining an airborne laser with satellite imagery and a few carefully selected ground plots, we were able to come up with a very accurate portrait of what the above-ground carbon looks like. And so this color chart shows the darker blues and purples are, this is the town of Puerto Maldonado right there, which has, it's a town, so there's very little carbon there. But then the areas in green are the different levels of carbon stored in the rainforest. Now, if you flew over this with an airplane, the whole thing would look a solid belt of green. You wouldn't be able to distinguish what the laser has shown us here. So the darker greens are areas of rainforest that are on floodplains. Richer soils, the trees grow taller, more carbon. The yellowish greens are places that are on very ancient soils where the nutrients have been eroded, and so the trees don't grow as tall. So to you, this would all look the same. To the laser, they're very, very different. This is vital because if you're going to set up a system where you're going to trade carbon, you need to know how much is out there in a very accurate way, and this new device gives it to us. I'll skip that. So this has also been, this first experiment was done on the island of Hawaii, and what it shows is how much more accurate these new technologies can be than the old standard way. So on the left is what Hawaii looks like in terms of the amount of carbon. Anybody here been to the Big Island of Hawaii before? Okay, so you know this. So this is the Big Island of Hawaii, and the white part is the volcanoes and the lava, so there's no carbon there. But you can see the rainforest along the perimeters. But using just simple ground plots to try to estimate it, you have a very high level of carbon, it looks like, in some of these forests. You then apply the airborne laser, and you see much greater variation. And in fact, some areas that the ground plots say have lots of carbon have actually very little, and vice versa. So a much more accurate way of doing it. Now let's imagine we're flying in from the northwest over Hawaii to give you the sense, the perspective for this next slide. So this is what Hawaii looks like from the airborne laser of mapping out the carbon. So the redder areas, richest, highest in carbon values, and you can see that sort of crescent right there is the one that's up in the far corner there. So a very different, first time ever, map of a large area, and now we're taking that around the world to map the rainforest on Earth to get ready for this emerging carbon market. That's the first problem is, okay, so we know how much carbon is out there. The next is monitoring it, because we have to set up a protocol where countries can report the amount of emissions coming from rainforests in order to set up this payment stream. And the challenge is to monitor not only the deforestation, which you can do with satellites, but then also the degradation. As fine scale as like a logging road or a tree is cut down in the forest, some new technologies are able to actually map that. And this is another innovation created by our colleague Greg Astner that will be on Google Earth Engine within the year that will allow anybody who has access to a laptop, has no knowledge of remote sensing, can say, I want to know how much, let's pick somewhere here in Maine, I want to know how much carbon is in the forests in northern Maine and what the change has been from, say, 2010 to 2005 to 2002. You go on Class Light on Google Earth Engine, you select with your mouse, you draw around the polygon that you want to know the area, and then you type in the dates you want to compare, and you hit send, and it gives you back the answer. So I just condensed about 15 steps that the program saves for the sake of time and effort, but that this is a fully automated program that will allow us to revolutionize the way that we monitor the rainforest and not only catch and hopefully stop the cheaters who would violate the protocols. I'll skip that one, but go to another astounding technology that our colleague Greg Astner has introduced. Now, we know that tropical rainforests, the plants all look alike. There's a reason for that, is that evolution has selected for plants to have leaves to have a certain shape, but even though they have a very similar shape because of the rain patterns, humidity, avoiding herbivory by insects, a variety of reasons, here's two different species that look exactly alike but are very, very different in terms of the chemical composition in those leaves. So these are two Hawaiian species, and you can see all of them listed in this column here in the middle, and how it doesn't matter what the bars mean, but just notice the variation in these different colored bars, which are variation in concentrations of plant chemicals. Well, Greg had the idea, I'm sure a lot of you have taken chemistry courses here in that awful period when you had to use spectrometers and run your sample through that and how the light is diffracted and you can then tell what compounds they are. It's the same principle with leaves. So you run the leaves through a field spectrometer, you get a reference slide of what its chemical composition is, and then on an airplane, instead of a laser that sends down an active pulse of 100,000 pulses a second and measures the echo back to give you the three-dimensional structure, this is a passive sensor that measures the light reflectance off the leaves and then tells you what species of tree is below you. Totally amazing. And it's now working. So here's just an example of this. It's first done in Hawaii, now applied to Peru, that the Jet Propulsion Laboratory just built, Greg, this $7 million sensor that is able to hopefully distinguish 40 different compounds in the leaves to be able to identify canopy species, canopy trees to species, at the scale of thousands of hectares a day. So the questions of how tropical species are distributed across these vast rainforests, which became impossible to ever estimate, now within a few years should be at hand. It may be that within the next decade, we'll be able to identify every single canopy tree in the tropics and know how much carbon is in it and these other chemicals, but then also to know something about the distribution of other tropical species that depend on these trees. So this is what it actually looks like, is the trees in the Hawaiian forest here are color-coded by the different types of which species are which. Okay, well, now on to a species that is close to my heart and to Philip's. There's no question that one of the aspects of the sixth great extinction crisis in our planet is that there's a disproportionate effect on the large mammals that still remain. Partly because some of them are hunted for their body parts, but mostly because they tend to wander over large areas or need large areas to survive, especially like the big cats and the elephants, is that we are simply crowding them out. And one of the real concerns is for this species in particular, the tiger. A few years ago, some colleagues of mine and I published a paper where we looked at the historical distribution of the tiger, the distribution in 2005, and then comparing it with the distribution of tigers we measured back in 1995. And what this slide shows is the area in the ivory color is the tiger's historic range. What it shows in green is the range today. And what we deduced is that tigers now occupy only 7% of their historical range. So they're undergoing what biologists call a range collapse. They used to be widespread until a few hundred years ago. They're now concentrated in these 76 different polygons that we call tiger conservation landscapes. And what we found is that when we compared tigers where they are distributed in 2005 with 1995, is that over that decade, tigers occupy 40% less area than they did 10 years ago. So this truly is, it's not only a range collapse, but a lot of these places that used to have tigers, the habitat's still there, the forest is still there, but the tigers have been poached out. Just after we published this paper, the Indian government, which was thought to be a stronghold for tigers, that we thought as many as 3,500 to 4,000 tigers were in India, decided that they actually only had about 1,400. And so the population of tigers was then put a few years ago at about 3,200 tigers in the wild. To put that in perspective, there are more tigers in private hands in the state of Texas than there are in the wild. There are more tigers on tiger farms in China than there are in the wild. So we realized, my colleagues and I who were working on this, that what we were doing wasn't working. We'd seen episodes of recovery of tigers, because tigers, after all, are just big cats. With the right conditions, with enough habitat, enough prey, tigers can have a litter almost every year, 4 to 5 cubs in a litter. Tigers and wolves are the two top predators that have the potential to breed as fast as their prey. So we know tigers can recover, but what we were doing wasn't working. And so we decided that we need to do something really different to try to avoid the extinction of this vitally important species that we've learned recently, just the role of these large predators in structuring the whole ecosystem around them. And so we decided about 3 years ago to come up with the idea of a global tiger summit, the first ever summit based on the conservation of a single species. And it didn't really catch fire right away, but eventually we were joined by some other tiger enthusiasts. One is President Robert Zoellick of the World Bank, who turns out to be, he was a former member of the WF National Council, loves tigers and did everything that he could to make this summit a success. And then Vladimir Putin, who also is a tiger lover, and our colleagues in WF Russia managed to convince the Kremlin this would be a great thing to do. So in November of 2010 in St. Petersburg, bitter cold. I mean, some of these guys who flew from the tiger range states in the tropics had a great surprise when it was snowing in St. Petersburg and we arrived. But the spirit was there. This is a picture of, we had on the left here, an animation of a tiger. It's too bad I can't show it here, but running across the walls of the Kremlin. So it made a big impact. More importantly, in St. Petersburg, in the auditorium, we had the heads of the 13 tiger range states represented, and all agreed to this goal of, in the year of the tiger, which is in 2010, which is why we had the summit then, is to get to what we call T times two, to double the number of wild tigers by the next year of the tiger, which comes every 12 years, to about 6,500. And to do that, we have to restore the core breeding areas of tigers, but then also go back to what I said before, is to restore a landscape. So now I'm going to just focus on, and end this talk on, focusing on one landscape that I've spent most of my adult life, or since I was 21, working in, which is the Troarc landscape. And what I want to introduce here is one piece of jargon for you, the idea of a metapopulation. And what a metapopulation means is managing species and populations in a way that are as one, where they're linked by dispersal. So here's an important piece about tigers, is that even though they're the largest terrestrial predators on Earth, that males can walk more than 15 miles in a day, they can swim across flooding monsoon rivers, they're powerful swimmers, they're terrible dispersers. They get to the edge of a rainforest, and there's maybe more than 4 kilometers of hostile terrain in between, and they won't cross it. So in order to make a metapopulation work where tigers can disperse from A to B to C and maintain gene flow across this large area, you have to have connected forests. And so that became our goal in the lowlands of Nepal, in this string of 12 tiger reserves across lowland Nepal and northern India, to connect all of them by a forest corridors, and where that connection was severed, to restore those forests so tigers could move through them. This is the place where, this is actually a talk that I just presented in Finland last week attended by the president of Finland, and one of our co-authors is actually the former forest minister of Nepal. But this is the landscape that I work in. That's the Annapurna Range in the background. This is only 600 feet elevation here, 26,000 feet in the background. And those are the world's tallest grasslands. Here the grass gets to be over 25 feet tall at the end of the monsoon. A tremendously vibrant ecosystem, great resilience. It has the highest concentration of tigers on Earth, tigers with the smallest home ranges. And we've been censusing tigers in the Nepal part of the Troarc, using infrared camera traps to get their numbers, and found that there's about 155 tigers in Nepal, adult tigers in Nepal. Nepal has committed to doubling that number in 12 years, so we want to get to over 300 adult tigers by 2022. In order to do that, we have to reestablish these corridors, which are shown in green here, between the tiger reserves. So how do we do that? Well, let's go back to our carbon example from the Amazon. One of the things that we learned in research this past 2 years is that if you look at where the tigers are distributed, these landscapes, which are outlined in green here, that the areas that contain or recently contain tigers hold 3.5 times more carbon than forests that have lost their tigers. So basically, if you want to stabilize the climate and you want to focus on where the carbon is, you go where the tigers are. Then we realized that tigers could become, when I tried to explain red to you, it probably just sort of went right by, because it's a very complicated mechanism, but maybe we can use tigers because they do concentrate in areas with high carbon as a way of identifying and putting a face on the idea of red in Asia. And this is a quote from India's former Minister of the Environment, who made the point that this is not just a middle-class obsession to save tigers, is that saving tigers truly saves these ecosystems that provide critical ecosystem services that communities depend upon. And to give you an example, in the lowlands of Nepal, over 90% of the natural resource needs of the local people for firewood, fodder, medicinal plants, everything comes from the forest. So if they don't have a forested environment, they won't have the natural resource base to lift them out of poverty. But is it a dream to think about, a pipe dream to think about, that you could have a connected landscape, a connected network of reserves in a human-dominated landscape with over 7 million people in this area and millions of cattle? And so the answer is yes. And this is one of the advantages of being older, I've discovered, is that you can go back to your research sites, you can take a picture, and you can go back a number of years later and see what progress you've made. So this was in 1990, which was the very beginning of our program to work with local communities to take over the management of the forest next to reserves. This was after putting up a fence to keep the cattle out in the foreground. And you can see, though, in the background, the forest that was just starting to protect it, how low the stature is. But that's one monsoon growth. You can see also in the background how the trees have been hacked, the branches, that kapok tree, which is silk cotton, kapok, in the same family as the baobab tree of Africa, very balsa wood, very soft wood, very good fodder. So the people were destroying the forest right in front of them. And we thought, let's just put a fence up and see what happens with the resiliency of the monsoon. Well, 18 years later, I came back, and that's me for scale in the white shirt, and that's the same tree having grown out again, and the forest sort of leapt out of the ground. That's Albizia lucida forest, a kind of legume that dominates it. But even after 3 years of protection, the tigers and the rhinoceros and the elephants and the bird life started coming back in these forests that were managed by communities. This became the basis for our effort to convince communities who live between the reserves to restore the forest and get the benefit. This is an area that 3 years before this picture was taken was a village community of 14,000 villagers that voluntarily asked to be moved out of an enclave in the park closer to a city or town. 3 years later, it was populated by rhinoceros and tigers. So the tremendous resilience of this landscape helped us to realize that, you know, these places could recover very quickly. So back to our red example, that Nepal is one of the leaders in developing this initiative in Asia. And we think that where red has the best chance of success is where you have these benefit streams going to communities set up over 20 years ago, and you're simply adding another benefit onto a system that's already functional. So here again, we mapped the carbon in the Troyarc landscape. This is set doing it by helicopter rather than a small plane with our colleagues from the Arbonaut company in Finland. And so all of that effort, though, is to find ways to increase, to bring greater value to these forests standing than cut down to the communities. But the problem with red and other of these mechanisms is that we run the risk of preserving the habitat, but without the possibility, perhaps, of any tigers or elephants or rhinos in them, because there's no economic incentive under red to conserve the wildlife in those forests. So we could end up with empty forests. So we came up with a new idea, again championed by the president of the World Bank, Robert Zoellick, we call the wildlife premium market. And this idea focuses on this basic premise that we think that what I'll call charismatic carbon is more valuable to investors than non-charismatic carbon. And by charismatic carbon, I mean for tropical forests that still have their tigers, their elephants, their orangutans, their jaguars, their gorillas, their lemurs, even the jiu-jitsu lemur, which is there in the middle, and hornbills, birds of paradise, whatever species meets the criteria of being A, flashy looking that the public would like to see preserved and has a familiarity with, but that's the PR side. But more importantly, on the science side, is wide-ranging is forest-dwelling tropical species that needs big areas to maintain viable populations. That's a scientific definition. So the idea is that we could create a financial mechanism where communities would actually get a payment on top of the carbon payment for agreeing to certain recovery targets for these endangered species. So in the case of Nepal, and the villagers who live in the communities between national parks, the first step would be to remove the cattle from these forests, because the cattle eat up all the vegetation that the tiger prey would eat and also come into conflict, and tigers sometimes kill the cattle, which leads to the tigers being poisoned themselves. So the plan is to remove the cattle from the forest, have them be kept on the premises of the farms themselves where they're stall-fed. They produce more dung, which goes into biogas digesters that we give to the communities, and have a more complete circle there. But then when you remove the cattle from the forest, then the wildlife comes back, the prey species of the tigers and the tigers themselves. And so that's the idea of this graduated payment, where we agree with communities to help double the number of tigers in these exterior forests, and they get an income stream through that way. Well, one of the other innovations that we're using to monitor the tigers is with the Nokia company, where we are developing the first or second generation cellular tracking devices. So there's good cell phone coverage over most of the tropics now, and certainly low in Nepal. And we're working on some prototypes to put out on some elephants, domestic elephants, next month as our guinea pigs, where we'll be able to call up the elephant and find out where it is, or they'll call us and provide us with the information we need to better protect wildlife, and see how they move through these forest corridors through the Terai. Now, this is a species that you will not see at the Westminster dog show. This is an Indian wild dog, or a dhole. Had his picture taken with a camera trap. It's rare you ever see these, but using these devices, it's very easy to find species that are hard to see elsewhere, but also to census wildlife. And there are techniques available now to be able to census tigers from their photographs using the stripe patterns on their flanks. Now, you need two cameras, because one on each side, because the left side can have a different stripe pattern than the right side. That's a technicality. But the methods are worked out where you could actually estimate the numbers of tigers. So we'll use these camera traps to be able to document the presence of tigers in these wildlife premium pilot areas. And if communities can document a tiger recovering, then we give them this financial incentive. So rather than pay people compensation when tigers kill their livestock, we will pay them compensation or an incentive for having tigers and having tigers as neighbors. So kind of turning that on its head. And so that's basically the idea of using some of these technologies to help advance our way of monitoring. So what I've hopefully shown is that how we've taken four distinct conservation targets: recovering tigers, trying to stabilize the climate, securing forest carbon, and at the same time improving rural livelihoods, using tigers as the face of all of this to the global community. Now I'm going to end with something that is so new that I don't even have a slide finished yet. Half the slide's not done. There's going to be a paper coming out in Nature. This is my last slide. Paper coming out in Nature in the next few weeks, that the theme of it is how industrialized agriculture is going to change the face, the surface of the planet, of the terrestrial part of the globe, in the next coming decades. So vast plantations of oil palm, pulp and paper, acacia, soy plantations, cattle ranches in the tropics are decimating tropical forests. And this juggernaut has not been tamed. Our idea is that one of the developments of poor land use, or the outcomes of poor land use in the tropics, is that there are vast areas of poorly managed, degraded, or even abandoned lands in former rainforest areas. So large that in the country of Brazil, there's an area the size of France that is that essentially abandoned lands. Similarly, in Indonesia, vast areas that could be put under production. The other thing is possible now is to be able to measure, as I've shown you, the amount of carbon in these areas, not only just by airplanes, but from space. And so we're working with Woods Hole to combine some technologies, where the idea is to measure all those areas that have a carbon value of less than 35 tons a hectare. Therefore, I'm not sure what this creature is. It could be something from Middle Earth. It might be half half lemur, I don't know, half tree kangaroo, kinkajou, I'm not sure. Anyway, the idea is that at 35 tons of carbon a hectare, that's a very degraded landscape. It might be a degraded grassland with a tree or two in it. That area is not worth conserving for biodiversity. And so the scientists will say to the major producers, go there. That's where you should do your work. Don't cut any more rainforest. There's plenty of areas that are less than 35 tons a hectare. Everything above 35 tons, let's set aside for conservation. So what we're producing in the next few weeks is a map that shows across the tropical rainforest belt of the world where these polygons, these clusters of areas less than 35 tons can be, and that's where we're going to drive to this development, to push these big producers of soy and oil, palm oil and beef cattle and sugarcane to those degraded areas and leave the rainforests for the lemurs and the tigers and the elephants and the jaguars, et cetera. And as consumers, this is still in the hypothetical stage, but as consumers, the idea is we'd have a little symbol, whether it's a tub of margarine or it's a paper product, and you look for your little lemur on there with an arrow that points down and say 35 to know that you don't have to worry about how this product was sourced. You don't have to worry about if it caused the destruction of rainforest, because it's guaranteed by having the symbol on there that it was sourced in a sustainable way. And then the whole idea is to put this on Google Earth Engine, we're talking with them now, so that anybody in the world can monitor how these forests are being used, and so that the companies are not indeed saying that they're sourcing them properly and then going into the rainforest and cutting it down. So if we can put all of these things together with a little bit of luck and a lot of ambition, I think that there is a future for tropical conservation and for life on Earth, but we have to act very quickly. Thank you very much for your attention. If anybody wants to ask me questions afterward, I'm happy to stick around. So if they're running, if anybody needs to leave or...
Thank you for your talk. I just had a quick question. From what I've learned in environmental studies, I know one of the hardest parts of conservation is meeting both the needs of the local people, so to speak, and the your goals with restoring habitats to their healthy environment. And it seems that in Nepal, like, you were able to really meet both of those needs. And I was wondering how, in the case of the ranchers in the grasslands, how you were able to meet their needs, but also restore them to their healthy state.
Well, that's a really tough question. I mean, it's an easy answer, but politically charged. It's a very different system. It's such a contrast from Nepal, where you'll have thousands of villagers, you know, with maybe, probably 20% of people landless, and then the others with very, very small holdings who are subsistence agriculturalists. In the northern Great Plains, you have typically the ranch size for an individual family might be 30,000 acres. But because it's so low productivity compared to the floodplains at the base of the Himalayas, the ranches have to be big. The cattle need these large areas for grazing, often overgraze them. But because this area that we focused on, we chose an area. We wanted to find the most remote area in the lower 48 states that had the fewest people and that hopefully had a low rainfall so that it really was not productive to either raise cattle or grow wheat. So under 12 inches of rain a year, it's really difficult to do both. Basically, a lot of the ranchers that are there now are kept alive by subsidies. If subsidies ended tomorrow, the West would look different overnight. You know, there'd be a lot of places like where we're trying to work now. But what we're doing is offering to buy those ranches from willing sellers and even help them find better quality land in other parts of the West with much more rainfall, closer to markets, where it's a lot more tenable to raise cattle or grow a grain crop. So that's the option we give them. We can just buy the land outright. And most of the people, the other criterion is, in this area, the average age of a rancher is over 65. So most of these are families who have been, they were the early settlers, but their kids have all moved off. Maybe one of you is from that area now, who knows. But they moved off to Spokane or Denver or Seattle to find jobs because there are no jobs out there. So the kids aren't going to inherit the ranches. The inheritance taxes are too high. this is probably not a way of life that's going to be perpetuated. And so we're offering, I think, a really good deal for people in this area to move somewhere where it's a lot more profitable. And we've had already a number of ranchers who have sold their properties to us. We need to get, we have to buy about 700,000 acres, of which we've already bought about 130,000. So we're on our way, and the rest of it is federal land. Our tax dollars are going to help in National Wildlife Refuges to help establish this landscape. You can also shout, too. I'll hear you.
I'm just curious how you account for climate change in deciding where you're going to place these reservations, such as in the plains, assuming that with a climate change, you also have a change in the vegetation, which would affect the landscape as well.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. So the climate change models that we've run for this part of the U.S. and Canada suggest that this area will get even drier in the years to come, which... I'm not so worried about the bison because these creatures are they're ice age survivors. They survive drought and extreme cold and flat faced bears. They just didn't survive us and rifles, but now they're coming back. I think that bison are incredibly resilient. They can go, unlike cattle that have to drink twice a day, they can go at least 36, 48 hours without drinking. But if it is true that the climate in, say, 20, 30 years will be drier than it is now, even more reason for ranchers who are in this area to think about going to a more mesic or wetter location because it's going to be even harder to make a living with less rainfall. So for this particular area, I think going with nature makes more sense. We have a sister example in the country of Namibia where colleagues of ours who work there have produced a model that shows that at a certain threshold of rainfall, that the wild ungulates do much better. They're much more productive than domestic livestock. And now Namibia has turned its economy around to focus on both wildlife ecotourism and sport hunting and hunting for meat for these poor communities, that it's much more efficient to do that using the native wild ungulates than it is to use cattle. So for certain ecological systems, I think that this actually works pretty well.
So if I could add to that, on the isolated populations, such as like the top of mountains that force the populations to move up into the mountains, uh-huh. How do you approach that from a climatic standpoint?
With fingers crossed and trepidation, I've been talking about this a lot with people in our climate program, and I think if we're honest, the changes are coming, the trajectories that we're on are coming so fast that in most cases, species as a whole will not be able to adapt to how rapidly things are getting drier, hotter, wetter, whatever it is in the place they're in that they didn't evolve under those circumstances. Those species that can move up mountains hopefully will do so, that if they're good enough dispersers. Those are at the tops of mountains, are in tough shape. My own hope is that those species that are ancient enough have embedded in their genome the ability to, they've lived through previous fluctuations of hot and dry and cold and wet, that some segment of that population, in the variability of that population, however it's distributed, there's some small percentage that can adapt, that can already persist in those changing climatic conditions. And from that nucleus will emerge a different variant of that species, but able to withstand these changes that have the physiological adaptations to do that. That's the best we can hope for, I think, in some situations.
One more question.
Thank you for speaking here at Colby College. My question might be a little more into a specific direction, and it concerns pandas. And I read that pandas are now more of a commodity and that the Chinese government leases pandas to other countries to show in their zoos for 10 years. And these countries pay a large sum of money to the government of China. And I'm wondering if there's a way that we can financially subsidize animal conservation in general. Without certain species that might be iconographic to a certain area or have a good PR, as you said, without them becoming, so to speak, like putting a dollar sign on them. And for a point of comparison, it's as if China has chosen the panda to save over, say, the Baiji in the Yangtze River, mm-hmm. Which is now maybe possibly extinct. So is there a way we can be more equitable, not only with the way we spend our money to save species, and is there a way we can save species just in general on a more equitable level?
Those are good questions. First, let me just say something in defense of the Chinese, that I think that certainly, you know, people have mixed feelings about the rent-a-panda programs that are in zoos, but, you know, I would argue that, you know, most of those pandas that are being sent out, they're from their breeding center or several of their breeding centers, where those pandas, they'll never see the wild again. They'll always be in captivity. And to the extent to which those pandas serve as ambassadors for what we're trying to do in the wild, I think that that's an effective system, because people come away, you know, marveling that a creature like this could have evolved in this way, and that, you know, what a glorious thing it is. It's such evolutionary exuberance, and hopefully they'll do something more to help conserve it. But to give the Chinese some credit, when I joined World Wildlife Fund in 19, back then. One of my first and most unenviable tasks was having to debate the renowned wildlife biologist George Schaller on NPR, where in his book, The Last Panda, he castigated World Wildlife Fund for, even though we paid for part, he's been somebody, my idol, and we're very close friends, but at the time, he still castigated my organization for wasting a lot of money on panda conservation. Specifically, we purchased, I believe it was 24 Land Rovers for the Chinese officials, for the panda conservation effort, and only when we got to the 24th Land Rover, it actually made its way to a panda reserve. The other 23 sat in garages in Beijing, and that was, to him, unconscionable. Well, that was the price to pay for getting into China during just after the end of the Cultural Revolution, when the country was not open at all to the idea of Westerners working there or collaborating in any way. You look at that period when there were maybe 5 or 6 panda reserves established and the population was crashing. Now there are over 65 panda reserves. The population has doubled. There's a room full of panda researchers, a room this size of panda researchers from China, who are intensely committed to their conservation, and so is the government. China can do, as we know, amazing things when the government puts its mind to it, and what we want to see next is China take the example of giant panda conservation to recovery of tigers in the area that's right across from Russia and North Korea, that could probably now has maybe 5 or 10 tigers in it that cross the border from Russia, look around and head back because there's nothing to eat, is to probably establish a population of 100 tigers there. That could be done very quickly if the Chinese do the same thing they did for giant pandas. So maybe the dolphin is next, but I think that you have to, you know, you have to work with the examples that you have, and I think that the Chinese actually could lead the way in some major restoration efforts, but the right incentives have to be there.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. Today's speaker was Dr. Eric Dinnerstein, Chief Scientist and Vice President of Conservation Science at the World Wildlife Fund. He recently spoke at Colby College in Waterville as a guest of the Environmental Studies Program. If you'd like to purchase a taped copy of today's Speaking in Maine, please call MPBN's Audience Services Department at 1-800-884-1717. Again, for a copy of today's Speaking in Maine with Dr. Eric Dinnerstein, the number to call is 1-800-884-1717. You can also listen to the program again at any time by accessing it on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand or Podcast to access this program, as well as many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Charles Beck is the executive producer of this series. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Lindsay Maynard.